when developing and increasing our capacity for compassion in our lives, a basic rule is to work with rather than struggle against. To work with one's own unwanted and unacceptable feelings and behavior. This prepares you to face the unacceptable and the unwanted in your life with loving kindness for yourself. This non-dualistic approach is true to the heart because it's mindful of the kinship we have with each other. We know what to say without condescension to someone who is suffering because we have mindfully experienced closing down, shutting off, being angry, hurt, or rebellious, and have made a relationship with those things in ourselves. So please take a moment to warmly greet those around you. Give them your best good morning. We welcome you to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan. As we cultivate inner awareness, the conditions become more conducive to opening the heart to its essential intelligence. We feel more joy in this moment. It takes courage to move into the knowledge of the uncertainty in our lives. We do not know when tragedy will strike. Dwelling in fear and rushing cuts off joy. One must practice appreciation and joy by remaining open to life's gifts and training in the skills of generosity. We gather this morning with one another to be joined in our common humanity, to celebrate the love that connects us all and our basic goodness. In this place, we expand the space for joy. In this morning, may we awaken our hearts to our basic goodness, the basic goodness of all being. May this light of compassion and justice shine through our moments of painful darkness and illuminate the loving kindness that heals all wounds. May it lift us up into the noble tenderness in this life we are here to share. So let us now stand as you are able and sing number 44, We Sing of Golden Mornings.
Sing the earth's great splendor. us close.
I call your attention to the announcements in our order of service. And in addition to that, I'd like to share with you that this evening at 5, choral evensong at the Episcopal Church will take place, and we would invite you to attend that if you feel so called. Ours is a welcoming community where we find connection, a loving community where we find meaning. Ours is a sharing community where our joys are amplified, a caring community where our sorrows are lessened. We take this moment to reflect on our joys and sorrows and acknowledge the mutual support of our community. If you would like, please share a brief personal expression of a special joy or sorrow.
Okay, for those of you who have been here for over 20 years, know Jim Mitchell. And he fell last Sunday and injured his shoulder and broke his arm. And I understand he's still in the hospital. He hasn't been moved back to Meadowlark. So if anybody goes to the hospital, just stop by and say hello. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ken Embers. I have joy. I got to participate in the yesterday Rotary's Manhattan Peace Forum. It was a Eastern District. There were about 15 Rotary clubs that participated and sponsored, and we had speakers from all over the United States. Our keynote speaker was Mary Jean Eisenhower, President Eisenhower's granddaughter. She gave a great talk about people to people. I spoke about the Libraries of Vietnam Project and my special project, the Bong Song Lucky Stars Library Learning Center, and John Exdell was there, and he spoke for the Manhattan Peace and Alliance. It was a great conference. I might add, when I was in Vietnam in 68 and 69, the students were protesting for peace. It's now moved up the ladder to the establishment, and now the establishment is promoting peace. I think that's a sign of progress.
Jim Chanteau. Speaking of people to people, Ann Marshall and I have just returned from a extended trip down to Cuba. And you hear it now? That was a people to people sponsored mission for us to meet, greet, and become aware of what's going on in Cuba today. Be happy to share this after I get some pictures developed and so forth. But just to put it quite briefly, found the Cuban people very friendly, very responsive, very curious about us, just as we are curious about them. Found it to be a marvelous trip. I just wish I hadn't gotten sick.
May we remember those who have spoken, those they have named, and those we hold in silence in our hearts.
Mark. Let's take this first.
Does this work? Oh, wow, cool. So a couple of weeks ago, Michael told me that today's topic sort of was living with uncertainty. So all the people that are over there that only see my hand, you are really living with uncertainty. good morning. My name is Sandy Nelson, for those of you who don't know, and I was thinking about living with uncertainty and how, while adults certainly do that, kids do too. And the thing that I thought of that all kids probably could really relate to living with uncertainty was a particular evening in December when you go to bed and you just don't know the next day if someone's going to show up in the middle of the night and leave you something or not. Anybody know what I'm talking about? What? Yeah, boy, and you guys really had emotion there about, do you get that feeling in the pit of your stomach like, wow, is Santa going to come or not? What's going to happen tomorrow? No? Never? Oh, man, I always had a real hard time going to sleep, and my stomach was in knots. You know, I can teach you something to help you go to sleep.
Nighttime and I keep waking up.
Okay, thanks. So I found this book. Actually, I only got this book. Jessica Long found the book for me. She's at the library. She's Colton and Katie's mom. And she found some really fabulous books to explore the idea of living with uncertainty. So you guys can help follow along with this and, like, what's going to happen next. And the story is called That's Good, That's Bad by Marjorie Cuyler? C-U-Y-L-E-R. Have you read this story before? So part of this is to think about the good and the bad of the uncertain future, okay? One day, a little boy went to the zoo with his mother and father. They bought him a shiny red balloon. Giant, humongous, shiny red balloon. It lifted him high up into the sky. Wow! Oh, that's good. No, that's bad. Because the balloon drifted for miles and miles until it came to a hot, steamy jungle. It broke on the branch of a tall, prickly tree. Pop! Oh, that's bad. No, that's good. Why would that be good? Because the little boy fell into a muddy river. Splat! He climbed up onto a roly-poly hippopotamus. Yeah, and rode to shore. Giddy up! Oh, that's good. No, that's bad. Why is that bad? You know, yeah, it could be horrible. That's bad because 10 noisy baboons were squabbling in the grass by the river. They chased the little boy up a tree until he was out of breath. Oh, that's bad. No, that's good. That's good?
That's good. That's a humongous snake in that picture. You are right. That baboons wanted to play vine swing with the little boy. That's good. What fun! The little boy grabbed a vine and swung out of their reach. Aha. Whee! Ah, that's good. No, that's bad. The vine was a big, scary snake that wiggled and jiggled and hissed. Oh, that's bad. No, that's good. I don't know. The little boy lost his grip. Whoops! Landed on the back of a giraffe. Hooray! Oh, that's good. Oh, that's bad. You are right.
Well, that's good. Because he landed safely on a giraffe.
That's right. But the giraffe leaned over to drink some swampy water. Glug, 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 glug. The little boy slid down its neck and fell into some quicksand. And next to an elephant, slop. Oh, that's bad.
No,
that's good. That's right. It's called having an optimistic outlook. The elephant grabbed the little boy with its trunk, lifted him up, up, up onto his shoulders. Whoosh! Oh, that's good.
No,
that's bad. Because the elephant thumped bumpily along the grassy plain where it stopped to feed. The little boy climbed down its trunk and woke up a daddy lion snoring in the grass.
That's
bad. Oh no, that's good.
No, that's
bad. You don't think so? When the lion saw the little boy, it purred and licked the boy's face. Oh, that's good. No, that's bad. The little boy got all wet and sticky. Yuck! And ran deeper into the jungle. It was dark as night in the jungle. Oh, the little boy was afraid. He sat down and started to boo. Oh, that's bad. No, that's good. His tears made a big puddle that a stork came along to have a drink. It picked up the little boy with his beak. Whoosh. Oh, that's good.
No, that's bad.
No, that's bad.
He's going to eat him.
No, I hope not. The stork flew the little boy across the dark, windy sky. Flap, flap, flap. The little boy thought he would never see his parents again. Sob. Oh, that's bad. No, that's good. The stork knew where it was going. It took the little boy back to the zoo, dropped him into his parents' arms, kerplop. His mother and father were so happy to see him. They gave him a big hug and a big kiss. Smack. Oh, that's good. No, that's great. Good job.
Go now in peace. Go now in peace. May the spirit of love surround you everywhere, everywhere you may roam. This
morning's offertory was composed to celebrate the fall of the Berlin Wall. The essence of generosity is letting go. Pain is always a sign that we are holding on to something, usually ourselves. When we feel unhappy, when we feel inadequate, we get stingy. We hold on tight. Generosity is an activity that loosens us up. Offering whatever we can, a dollar, a flower, a word of encouragement, we are learning to let go and to receive. According to the Buddha, the lives of all beings are marked by three characteristics: impermanence, egolessness, and suffering or dissatisfaction. Recognizing these qualities to be real and true in our experience helps us to relax with things as they are. The first mark is impermanence, that nothing is static or fixed, that all is fleeting and changing, is the mark of our existence. We don't have to be mystics or physicists to know this. Yet at the level of personal experience, we often resist this fact. It means that life isn't always going to go our way. It means there's loss as well as gain. And we don't like that. So, sometime in the fall, I think it was in the beginning of October, a group of us met to read and to move into the strange and wonderful territory of this book called Comfortable with Uncertainty, 108 Teachings on Cultivating Fearlessness and Compassion, by Pema Chodron. It helps a little bit to know something of Pema Chodron's biography. When she was a young mother with two children, her husband announced one day that he was out of there. He didn't want to be in this marriage anymore, and that was that. He left. Everything that she believed and felt held her life together, fell apart. The floor dropped out, the walls caved, and the roof collapsed. She was left wounded, angry, with so much fear about what life was going to bring next. She didn't know how she was going to make it from one day to the next. Luckily, she began to study with Choyam Trungpa Rinpoche, who was the man who introduced Tibetan Buddhism to the United States back in the late 60s in Vermont at a place called Shambhala Center, and in Boulder at the Naropa Institute. And she was lucky enough to begin to start attending some of these sessions. And over time, they began to take hold in such a way that she could no longer not look at the pain that brought her to be in the presence of this teacher. She had to sit with it. She had to breathe with it. She had to do everything with that pain. She couldn't let it control her in the way it does when you just let it be in the background, always there, always present, always with its weight pushing, but not acknowledging it keeps it back there, and it has a lot of control. And once she began to understand that moving into the pain in such a way that you're not making it into the biggest sob story that ever was told in the world, but in a way that you could say, this is what happened. This is how I feel. This is who I am. So you begin to find some stability in uncertainty. That no, you cannot tell that lightning to not hit you when it hits you. You cannot put on that button that says, let's go back 10 hours earlier. It's happened. You cannot put life on pause when all of a sudden the beautiful crabapple trees are just in full blossom in Kansas and the tulips are up and they're blooming, and then we get one of those 60-mile-an-hour day winds blowing and just all those blossoms are flying and the petals are shattering on the tulips, and you think, oh, why can't it just stop? That's the way I felt often in spring, because I love spring. I love that moment when the earth becomes warm and things are popping up and everything is blossoming. And in Kansas, it doesn't last very long, usually. And I would say, please, stop, stop. So I was trying to hold spring in place. And then one day a friend said to me, you don't even get to enjoy the moment that it's here because you're wishing it wouldn't stop. I said, what? And she said, you know, you just have to let it be what it is, enjoy it while it's there and not clench, not hold so tightly onto what's going to pass. Each of us have had moments in our lives when we would like to press pause or to go back a week before, or months before, or years before, where we could start all over again so that we wouldn't make this huge mistake, which is really bringing us into a place of extreme confusion, agitation, and even sometimes anger. Of course, we've all had those moments. And maybe some of you today are in that place when you would just like to say, can't we go back to last May? But we know, as rational, questioning, loving people, that you can't do that. That it's not possible. When you over-anticipate, you put a weight on things and you diminish the chance for spontaneity to bring its surprises. That feeling of unanticipated ease and pleasure. The magic available in every moment that's there if you just are present. When you're not pushing, when you're not rushing, when you're not wishing you were at home with the New York Times and a good cup of coffee. True vitality is not found, as we know, in skincare products or a buff body, as I can, or in a luxury car, or in a dream vacation, or in the perfect relationship with someone that you love dearly. At some point, life re-enters, and you get to know yourself again, as you are. Your persona, the mask you wear, is not your true self. We know that. We've all had those moments when we know we're just putting on the face when someone says, how are you doing? And inside you're just so pissed that you just like to scream. And you say, oh, I'm fine. We all do that. We know what that feels like. But when we do that, we invalidate something that's real and true and alive and present. We detach ourselves from that truth. That power of connection. Unitarian Universalism challenges us to move beyond appearances, beyond those labels that we say, oh, yes, I do this. Oh, no, I do that. This is what I like. This is the best place to go. All those things that we use to define ourselves and to say, oh, that's Michael. Those do not last. They will go away. And as people who are part of a faith tradition that is evolving, it is our obligation to follow that evolution inside ourselves. Who are we when we are no longer working for the National Geographic magazine? Who are we when we're no longer employed? And you don't get to say, who am I now? It's that place of knowing oneself regardless of all the things that surround us and tend to define us. The phrase, don't misinterpret, which is used a lot in Tibetan Buddhism, means you don't impose the wrong notion of what harmony is, what compassion is, what patience is, what generosity is. Don't misinterpret what these things really are. There is compassion, and then there is idiot compassion. There is patience, and then there is idiot patience. There is generosity, and then there is idiot generosity. For example, trying to smooth everything out to avoid confrontation, to not rock the boat, is not what's meant by compassion or patience. That is what is meant by control. That is what is meant by control. Then you are not trying to step into unknown territory because you are controlling the situation. You are not trying to be naked and lose all the protection of the facades and the masks that you wear. And you are not in contact with that fresh, raw, immediate reality of being you in this moment, in this space. Instead, you use the idiot forms of compassion and so forth just to gain some control over how you are feeling and how you might help others feel the same way. When you open the door and invite all the beings as your guests, the goal of radical hospitality, that culture of generosity shapes, you have to drop your agenda. You know that agenda? Does anybody have an agenda? Yeah, I do too. Many different people come in. How do you welcome this diversity? A formula won't work. Each person brings their unique gifts. You cannot treat each person the same way. But you still need to act with clarity and decisiveness. Clarity and decisiveness come from, yes, breathe, a willingness to slow down. A willingness to look at what's right here, right now. and feel what you feel instead of all the buzzing, all the churning, all the activity, to just be here.
Figure out how I can stand here and be heard. Can you hear me now? Okay. But I'm on my tiptoe, so. How's that? Okay. When this group was announced, I thought it would be really a great idea because since we have been facing recent and sudden changes in our life, I thought it would be great to study a book that talked about being comfortable with uncertainty. And the subtitle is 108 Teachings on Cultivating Fearlessness and Compassion. And that sounded like that would be very good for me. I have to admit that at first I found the book extremely difficult to understand. Partly it was because it was kind of formalistic, it seemed to me. You know, you do this and this will happen. And I have been exposed to that in Christian Science writings and not found them very helpful. So it took me a while to accept the way this book was written. And some of the terminology I wasn't familiar with, like, if I can pronounce it, Dharma, Paramita, Tonglen, Pranja. And so it took me, I had to get over my feeling about those words to begin to understand and get something out of the book. But I have to say, the more I do read it with a more open mind, the more I get out of it. And the more I can begin to understand some of it. I'm quoting some of the things that she said. She was talking about uncertainty. Nothing to hold on to. The truth is that things are always in transition. Nothing to hold on to is the root of happiness. If we allow ourselves to rest here, we find that it is a tender, non-aggressive, open-ended state of affairs. So now I feel like I can live with uncertainty much better than I did, and also without fear of what may be going to happen. Then she has a long discussion on loneliness, which I also found helpful. She says, cool loneliness, when you wake up in the morning and out of nowhere comes the heartache of loneliness and alienation. Use this as a golden opportunity. Relax and touch the limitless space of the human heart, awakening your heart. But actually, learning how to be in your heart is a work of a lifetime. And that was the most difficult part of the book for me to try to understand. Was it a metaphor? Was it all part of the deep breathing that goes along with meditation? I'm still working out on that one. And then another part about, she talks about contentment means that we no longer believe that escaping loneliness is going to bring happiness or courage or strength. And avoiding unnecessary activity means that we stop looking for something to entertain us or save us, like television, as one of our members brought up, and not seeking security from one's discoursive thoughts means no longer seeking the companionship of constant conversation with ourselves. Do you do that? I certainly talk inside my head all the time to myself.
I find I make now a conscious effort to tune out all these inner voices telling me to plan, to goal set, or what I should or should not be doing, but to live my life in my heart. An example is like when I'm swimming and my ears are underwater, I can't hear all the boom, 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 rat-a-tat of the construction going on around the pool. I can just relax and enjoy the flow of the water. I think that one other thing that I found very helpful, which is sort of funny for us, especially women, right now, can you make an unconditional relationship with yourself, just the height you are, the weight you are, the intelligence that you now have, and your current burden of pain? This I found very helpful when I discovered I've lost over 5 inches in height and gained multi wrinkles. But then a child took my hand and said, "You have old hands." And I said, "And you have young hands." And we compared the size of our hands and the texture of our hands. And I did not feel that that was depressing. I thought that was fun. I was also struck by something that wasn't in the book, even though we aren't supposed to do this. And just because it came along with all the feelings that I felt I had gained about enjoying every day and living it for its most, but also to begin to know my own feelings, and that that will help me see and better understand others. And I heard Justice Sotomayor say, "If you don't imagine how the other person is thinking, you can't know how to react to the other person." I try to build bridges, not chasms. I try to connect with others. I try not to see differences, but look for the best, not the worst, in an individual. Being a justice is fine walking with a listening mind. So that was my experience with the book.
I appreciate being a part of the group very much. There was a big burly samurai warrior who went to a Zen master, and he said, "Teach me the nature of heaven and the nature of hell." So the Zen master got in his face, and he said something to the effect, "Why should I teach a miserable, degenerate slob like you anything at all? Don't bother asking me. I'm a Zen master." And the samurai drew his sword in a rage and was ready to lop off the head of the Zen master. And he was just filled with the anger of the insult. And the Zen master said, "That's hell." And the samurai was just devastated by this. Oh my gosh, how could I have done this? How could I have filled my heart with all this dark, bilious hatred and prepared to commit murder just because my self-image was affronted and my defenses of my... my ego were thwarted so much by what he had said. And, "I am so sorry." And he fell on his knees and he begged forgiveness. And the Zen master said, "That's heaven." And that, it seemed to me, was a recurring theme of our discussions and of the contents of the book, and actually was beautifully amplified by the children's story this morning and of Michael's introductory comments. This is this ongoing kaleidoscopal kind of experience of being a human being and being from the external sources subject to heaven and hell, good and bad, but internally also experiencing these states of mind that we label good and bad, heaven and hell. And in fact, what Pima encourages us to do is to not embrace only heaven and eschew hell, but to be open to both, because that is our essential human experience. There's something that she followed up this samurai Zen master story with a really nice conclusion, it seemed to me. And I want to read that to you, if I can find it here. Somehow I've lost my page here. But this is the experience of uncertainty at this particular point. It's not only the embracing the dualities of experience that we attach our labels to, but the idea that actually in terms of the particular place and the particular relationship that you have and the particular event experience in that moment is actually all you really need to learn about who you really are. And it's as if, to carry that a little bit further, I think, than what her concluding statement was, that in the structure of the universe, you are exactly where you need to be to expand your consciousness. And that if that is really embraced and we're really open to that, then there is a tremendous vitality and potency that can be realized in that understanding. And I'm very grateful for the book, the group, Michael's excellent qualities as a facilitator of our discussions. And so it's a real pleasure to be a part of such a meaningful experience. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Lori Cross, and I want to talk to you about the uncertainty. When Michael indicated he was going to lead a group in October on Comfortable with Uncertainty, written by Pema Chodron, on exploration of the cultivation and compassion and awareness, I became interested. Although the topic interested me, it was because Pema Chodron was going to be in this discussion. And that is because she'd been well respected by two friends of mine that I respect a lot in Kentucky who had followed her for a number of years, and they were quite intrigued by her. I also found out later that my brother also liked Pema Chodron, as did a friend of mine. In compiling this presentation, I checked the internet and found a treasury of articles by Chodron, plus some films, including one by Bill Moyers, which is what my brother watched, and he was very impressed. I will offer a short presentation on reading The Comfortable with Uncertainty. Bodhicitta is the Sanskrit word that means noble or awakened heart. It is equated in part with our ability to love. No matter how committed we are to unkindness, selfishness, or greed, the genuine heart of bodhicitta cannot be lost. It is also equated in part to compassion, the ability to feel the pain with others. Based on a deep fear of being hurt, however, we erect protective walls made of strategies, opinions, and prejudices, emotions. It awakens when we no longer shield ourselves to the vulnerability of our condition from the fragility of existence. We train in bodhicitta practices in order to become so open that we take in the pain of the world and let it touch our hearts and turn it into compassion. The analogy for bodhicitta is the rawness of the broken heart. This is a link with all of us who've ever loved. It humbles us when we are arrogant and softens us when we are unkind. It awakens each of us when we prefer to sleep through and pierces through our indifference. The continual ache of the heart broken open is a blessing fully that can be shared by all. Even when we are feeling confused and hopeless, bodhicitta is like the open sky, is always there. It is there when we have a moment of caring for things, is available when we're appreciative of noticing the blue sky and listening to the rain. It is available in moments of gratitude, when we recognize kindness or recognize another's courage. It is available in music, art, and poetry. Whenever we connect with sorrow, with joy, let go of holding on to ourselves and look the world around us. As I was compiling this presentation, I was sitting in my kitchen last Friday with the television on. I just finished breakfast and looked out the window and was pleasantly surprised at the bright sunshine on the beauty and the serenity of the recent snowfall and the fascinating shadows falling on the snow. On the television, I heard Robin Roberts, co-anchor of the National Morning News program, being interviewed by Diane Sawyer. Robin had gone through the grueling experience of having a bone marrow transplant and had returned to work just the day before, after being gone for several months. She was welcomed back by a very warm, loving group of colleagues, but seemed like family. When asked, "How do you feel?" she said she's very focused on now. And it's what's happening right now, and she feels very fortunate, very good. It was a word now again. I, too, had experienced an extended recovery time from illness, a stroke, when I was only 41. This was happened many, many years ago. I returned to work on a part-time basis after convalescing for 3 months. But it took me several months before I was able to go back to work full-time. I remember, in time, I began to take more trips and went for the first time overseas. I realized then that now was the time to take these trips. When I had ovarian cancer diagnosed 3 years ago, initially I felt unfair. And how about going through the stroke, now this? But that feeling went away. And again, I felt fortunate and was determined to make my life as gratifying as possible. I am sure that the other survivors of cancer know exactly what I am describing. It is, as Pema Chodron would say, the essence of life is fleeting. It is okay to be frightened, but remembering impermanence can teach us how to cheer up. Your fear can heighten a sense of gratitude about the preciousness of being alive, the human birth, the opportunity for practice.
It's been a very bumpy road. I'm finding that I'm learning more this morning than I did in the last couple of months about this. and listening to the three before me has really touched me very much. I found the book very difficult to relate to, and admired those that you've heard that were able to apply it so well in looking at their lives. I could react to it professionally. I felt it presented very good therapeutic attitudes. I overreacted. Felt the book was asking me to let go of everything I counted on. In the midst of this, we took a short trip to Denver because I have a 40-year friendship, and with a very close friend and also my office mate for all the time that we both were in practice in Denver. And he has been dying of COPD, which is chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. And he's got great cylinders of liquid oxygen, or he did have many of them in the house, and it wasn't enough to give him enough oxygen to survive. And he was sure that he would not survive to find out who won the election. He was right. He did not. So it was very important. I had 2 hours of a very quiet talk with him, which was very satisfying. In addition, we visited our home at 8,000 feet, and I found, became very aware of my own problem with the limits on my ability to use oxygen, which obviously I'm dealing with at the moment. So when I returned, I found it difficult to get back into the group. But by the end of the evening, I was very energized and very engaged again with the help of the group process. I don't remember what particular it was that went on, but it was the group process. After we had finished our work, study, several of the people who were very facile and able to use this, obviously I have found out I was very defended against it until I heard Judy start dogging. So there were only two of us that wanted to do what Michael really wanted us to do, was to present what we had learned during the holidays. I wanted to put it off. So that's why it's now February. I was very uncertain and very concerned about what I would tell you. Well, I was happened to be reading a book by Fareed Zakaria, and lo and behold, he was talking about Hinduism and how it totally absorbed Buddhism in India. And I thought, wow, wonderful, certainty. I now know what I'm going to talk about. No problem. I was relieved enormously to find certainty. The only problem was, when I talked to Michael, he very gently let me know that, yes, that was very interesting, what I discovered, but sort of relevant, but really a separate topic. And I really needed to go back to the text. I did not particularly like that. I reviewed my notes and read and didn't get very far. I had been very intrigued with the warrior concept, that it really takes courage to open yourself to feeling. I obviously am awfully vulnerable to opening of feelings, and I think I was defended against that. The idea of the warrior who can deal with the fear and be very open to loving and to experiencing all of our existence. Another thing that particularly touched me was the unconditional loving kindness of self and other, and that it's absolutely necessary to feel that towards yourself and your own experience before you can treat other people that way. And also the concept of tonglen that Judy mentioned. At first I thought it was ridiculous. Why would you embrace pain and discomfort? Well, that means you don't procrastinate, but you really feel what you need to and what's going on. But so I reconsidered that, and a few nights ago, I woke up because I was having oxygen hunger because I was congested, and this so-called oxygen, which is just compressed air, depends on going through the nose. And that wasn't very available. So I was working very hard to get deep breaths. And I thought about tonglen. And realized that millions of people, literally millions of people all over the world, were probably feeling the same thing that I was feeling. And, many in a much worse state because of pollution or illness or age. And that was very helpful while I was dealing with the oxygen hunger until the decongestant took effect. And it was a very helpful and supportive concept to be in touch with that at that time. So I'm just beginning to open up to what's presented in this book.
This book is not very linear, and I appreciate chaos, but I also found myself wanting to organize it. And so when I went back to this week, I found myself, I couldn't pick one thing to talk about, so I found myself picking a thread that ran through it. And one of the themes that really spoke to me, all of them really did, and everything that you said spoke to me, but the thing I'm going to talk about is the idea of being curious and compassionate about yourself and how that leads to openness and compassion in other people. So what happens usually in a situation is that we have strong emotions or we're opinionated about something that's happening, and we take those emotions and we weave them together with what's really happening and we create our story. And this story isn't really what's happening, it's what we've told ourselves is happening. It's what's happening to us, and it's how we it's how we understand the situation. But what happens is it leads to stronger emotions. Like, I'm right, and you're wrong. Or you've wronged me, and this is not happening, or whatever. It's our story. It's not really what's happening. So, like Lori said, we're kind of scared, so we put up walls around our egos because they're fragile. And we want to protect them from the uncertainty of what's happening. And this causes us to feel separate from one another. So the author suggests that there's an alternative to this. She says, when strong emotions arise, we can breathe them into our hearts by acknowledging the emotion and dropping the storyline that we're telling ourselves and feeling the energy of the moment, we can cultivate compassion for ourselves. And my favorite example in this book, in a very kind of minute little moment, she says, you might just be having your coffee, and here comes the object of your fury. So what is her advice? You breathe that in. The idea is to develop sympathy for your own confusion. You don't blame the object, and you don't blame yourself. There's just liberated fury. And it's hot, and it's dark, and it's heavy, but you experience that as fully as you can. So you breathe the anger in, and you forget about him or her, and you just own it. It takes a lot of bravery. It's pretty insulting to your ego, but you breathe it in. And before it suffocates you, you breathe out relaxation and freshness and spaciousness, and you allow room for these feelings. In a way, you're ventilating your feelings. You're letting them happen. Michael said earlier, the basic ground of compassion is working with rather than struggling against. When you work with the hard, unwanted stuff, you eventually can relate to it because you've worked with it. We're not afraid to confront the uncertainty or the suffering in other people, like the hurt or the anger or the jealousy, because we've made a relationship with these things in ourselves. We can start to see that there's millions of people feeling the same way that we do. Is my jealousy any different than yours? Is your anger any different than his? Perhaps, perhaps not. When we recognize our own confusion with compassion, we can extend that compassion to others who are equally confused. It's in this step of widening the circle of compassion that lies the magic of all this, the magic of the open heart. Thank you.
Let us take a moment before we open our hymnal up to 93, to Mercy, Pity, Peace, and Love. And I would like to thank these brave, wonderful people who helped me to understand what it means to be in loving community. To be in loving community. So thank you all. So let us stand as you are able and sing our hymn.
Yeah.
joy and love be with you this day. Let us go into it with an open heart.